Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Counter, an NFL podcast from USA Today Sports.
Chuck, I really have to question our love for the podcast game because we just took last week off. We opted out of last week, man.
Yeah, I mean, personally, this is basically like wherever I've been for the past 15 years. Don't like expect anything out of me from December 23rd until the first Monday of the new year. So
just shut it down.
I'm not going to get anything done. Let's not kid ourselves about what we're trying to accomplish here in the last week. We're all trying to do as little work as possible. So, you know, I just try to embrace it. And I think we did a good job of that last week.
Yeah, we excelled at it, I think. Yeah. Really showed what it was all about. I basically had to put together like all my kids' toys and play with each one. So it felt more like work, actually. But
I was so busy just, you know, running around with my friends and doing nefarious things. It's just horrible. So busy.
Nice. Love it. All right. Well, we're back now. The Counter's here and we're ready for week 18 we're heading into. I guess this is not actually the first time the NFL season has ever gone 18 weeks. I think there was one season where maybe it spread out for some reason. My brain is very foggy, but it's the first time that teams are going to have to play 17 games. We're kind of planning to talk more about that on our next show. With this one, we want to go over a couple things. We've got Charles's Forvert, his weekly column, taking a look at four different intriguing storylines in the league. And in addition, we're going to talk about one of those storylines is what's going to happen with Jimmy Garoppolo, who appears finally ready for a divorce from the 49ers. We've been thinking that would be the case for a while now, but it does seem like it's going to happen. So we're going to take trace out where we think he could end up. But then we're also going to take a look at why it's happening, which is Trey Lance. And, you know, he really seems like a guy who's ready now. Whether or not you think he should have played earlier is probably something we could debate. But we're going to take a look at that. Then we're going to talk about a story that I dropped right before Christmas about a former NFL player, Casey Fitzsimmons, a tight end with the Detroit Lions, who shared with me his story of living through traumatic brain injury and just what that was like and how difficult it was for him to get help from the NFL and the NFLPA. And also that sort of dovetails with another big story from this past weekend, which was Antonio Brown flipping out in the middle of the Bucs game and just leaving the team. And that led to a robust discussion online about, you know, his mental state and should people be worrying about him as a football player displaying some of these things that players with CTE have displayed and whether it's even proper to talk about that. So it's an interesting debate, and I'm interested in getting into it and sort of talking through it. And then we're going to jump into another college football thing. We've been delving into that a little bit more in recent shows, but Kirk Herbstreit and Desmond Howard saying over the weekend that they didn't think today's players were dedicated to the game, had love for the game, that they were entitled because some of them, it's not even that many of them, opted out of meaningless bowl games. So we got a stack show. We got a lot to discuss. We'll get in a few other takes, but on the season here as we wind toward the end. I mean, it's an interesting spot where the league is right now. I guess there's three playoff spots available total, one in the NFC, two in the AFC. So things sort of did, you know, it feels like 5 weeks ago we were like, oh man, anything could happen. It's crazy. Now things have wrapped themselves up a little bit, mm-hmm. as we moved along, but, you know, we'll talk about all that on Thursday and some of the clinching scenarios and sort of trace forward what we think the first round of the playoffs is going to look like. The wild card weekend should be really interesting. But let's get into the Forverts, man. Your first of the Forverts is about our old friend Tua Tagovailoa. This poor guy, man, he's just...
Last week was real bad for him.
Yeah, it just feels like, you know, just completely, he's just not really had a chance to ever really feel comfortable. I don't know what's... The Dolphins are one of the weirdest teams, I think, right now. Because it just looks like one week that Brian Flores has them ready to be a juggernaut, and then the next week they just look completely lost. I've never seen a team that I feel is well coached at one point, and then the next week it just seems like there was no plan whatsoever. And Tua just is sort of stuck in that cycle right now. So what do we think? What is your take on what the Dolphins can do moving forward, where they stand as a franchise? This is a franchise that we were so high on. It's like, oh, they're stockpiling draft picks. They know what they're doing. They're building. They're doing it the right way. They got the coach. We just felt like it was on an upward trajectory, and now it just feels like it's all stuck in mud. So where does it go now?
I don't know, but I think that the Dolphins are like the kind of right back where they started, right? Where you're right back at the spot where you kind of realize that Tua might not be good enough and you need to explore options in the offseason. I also think that what that game showed you yesterday against the Titans, the Titans are the number one seed in the AFC, but I would not consider them like one of the elite teams in the AFC personally. But they're a lot better than the teams that they beat on this, seven-game winning streak. So you had the Texans, they beat 17-9. The Ravens, as they started to fall apart. Jets, Panthers, Giants, Jets again, and then the Ian Book Saints game. So, yeah, it's cool to get excited about, a seven-game win streak. And obviously, the point of playing in the NFL is obviously to win the games. But I think that some Dolphins fans on Twitter might have gotten ahead of themselves when they were ripping off these wins, because the quality of opponent was extremely poor during that, that seven game run. And they kind of ran back into a real opponent on Sunday. And you saw that, oh no, this is a team that actually has a long way to go. And not only that, their quarterback, even in the wins, hasn't really done anything to elevate them over the competition. So it's tough because now you just have to kind of figure out what's next. You spent a number five pick on Tua Tagovailoa, and these are the kind of players when you pick someone at number five, you're trying to get someone that's going to take your franchise to the next level. And I know that Tua has not always gotten the help that he needs from the Dolphins organization, but at some point, you got to show that you can play without that, Joe Burrow, even though he didn't have the cleanest rookie year ever, you saw the playmaking ability. Obviously we saw it with Justin Herbert too. Even with guys like Josh Allen, who started off pretty rough, you see the glimpses of supreme upside there. And with Tua, it's just not there. So I don't know what the Dolphins are going to do. Maybe they'll try to get back into the Deshaun Watson game, if they're really that desperate. But, I can imagine if you're a Dolphins fan, this is pretty frustrating because you went through six, seven, 8 years of Ryan Tannehill, didn't really get an answer. And now you looks like you have someone worse with Tua. So yeah, sucks to suck.
Sorry about that. Yeah, it's such a weird place for this team to be in because they have a ton of cap money. There's a ton of cap money to be spent. It's $75 million in cap space that they really, if Tua had turned out to be the guy, they would be in this absolute perfect spot to build around him. And if things had progressed the way that they thought they would, this is where you'd want to be. But now instead, it just looks like I'm not even sure where this team can go from here. I mean, are there what do they do at quarterback if they do move on from Tua at this point, knowing that this upcoming draft does not appear to have any studs? The Dolphins traded their own first round pick to the Eagles, but they do have a couple others. They still are pretty draft pick rich, which is why they could end up being in the Deshaun Watson trade. Obviously, trading for Watson would eat up a huge chunk of that cap.
yeah,
eat probably close to half of it, if I remember his salary correctly. What happens next?
Yeah, I don't know. I think the interesting thing is, another interesting thing about this is, like, does anyone want Tua at this point?
I mean,
because even when before the season started, when you had fewer reps, and you can kind of like sell the idea of mystique on, hey, this could turn out to work out pretty well for us. We still found out that the Texans were not really thrilled about the idea of getting Tua Tagovailoa back in return for Watson, even with draft picks. Like, I'm not sure that this is someone that's a coveted asset by the NFL, which kind of makes this even a little bit harder, because you might end up in a spot where you just have Tua on the bench, and then you have to decline his his fifth year option when it's time for that to come up with his contract. So, you know, they're really in a messy spot. It's just so fascinating that you had all these resources to kind of get back into relevancy, and they've honestly just burned it on a bunch of players that aren't very good. I mean, you go back to the Tua draft class, that first round looks disastrous now. If you have Tua, who doesn't look like he has any way of putting a team on his back, and then Austin Jackson, who I'm not sure if he's hurt or not, but when he has been on the field, he's arguably been the worst offensive tackle in the NFL. So, you know, they've made a lot of bad picks. They haven't used all their resources wisely. And now, you know, you get to the end of this run where you have multiple draft picks, and cool, you went 8-8 this year. You're probably going to go 8-9 after that Patriots game on Sunday, but you didn't really accomplish anything. And I think, you know, that 7-game win streak paired with that Titans loss on Sunday showed the real quality of this team, which is not very good.
Yeah. It's just one of the teams sort of just totally stuck right now without a very clear path forward. And, you know, I think we're going to talk about a couple of teams in similar spots when we talk about where Jimmy Garoppolo could end up. But that's sort of how you know, right? That's a good tell, is if you're looking for quarterbacks, and if you're grasping for a reclamation project, then your franchise probably is not figuring out where it needs to go. I mean, there are scenarios where you could be doing that, but you're sort of purposely taking on a quarterback like Tyrod Taylor because you know that maybe that season is not going to be great and you're in the very beginning of a rebuild. But, you know, this is not a friend. That's not where this Dolphins franchise should be.
Yeah.
You know, the process should not have led them here. And it'll be interesting to see, as you said, how Chris Greer and Brian Flores will try to pull it out at this point. Let's talk about sort of a flip side of your second item in the four verts, is sort of a flip side of that. And I'm completely fascinated by this. So basically the title here is Devondre Campbell is set to cash in after a monster season. Linebacker who came into the league with the Falcons. He's played for the Cardinals. Just not a guy who was, you know, I mean, he just appeared to be on the path to being a journeyman, maybe playing, you know, playing through his early deal and then bouncing around and nobody really talking about. And now, to your eyes, he's one of the best linebackers in the league playing for the Packers. He's just been fantastic.
It's bizarre. He was drafted by Atlanta. And, you know, I remember when in 2016, they had a really good draft class that year. It was like, Keanu Neal, Deion Jones, Austin Hooper, and Devondre Campbell were their first four picks, like guys who really helped them out as they, you know, navigated the Super Bowl season and the year after when they were still pretty good. And Devondre's always been a guy who, I mean, you just look at him. I remember watching him play at Minnesota, and, mm-hmm. you know, you're talking about a middle linebacker who's 6'4", 240, right. Runs a 4.5. I mean, just a freak athlete, but, you know, just down to down, it just didn't always translate for him. And, you know, sometimes it just kind of clicks late in the career for these guys where, you know, you have all the physical attributes and then you finally get the mental reps where everything starts to make sense for you. And I think that that's kind of what's happened for Campbell with the Packers. And, you know, you look at where the Packers are defensively, at least with their numbers, like they're one of the best defenses in the league. And honestly, a lot of that is due to him, which I would not have guessed coming into the year watching him play. Like, you know, there's a reason why he signed a 1-year, $2 million contract with the Packers. Like, that was just a plan for him to be a stopgap. Just get in there, let's see if you can play for a year, and then we'll figure out something else. But now, he's played so well that he's almost made himself like an indispensable player for the Packers, where they might have to actually throw a real bag at him and re-sign him. And I just thought that that was kind of a cool story, because it just never would have occurred to me that he would ascend and actually become one of the best linebackers in the league. But when you look at how much he's improved from last year to this year, just from PFF, like, he's cut down on his missed tackle percentage greatly. He's allowing like a career low in yards allowed per reception. And I think one of the funniest and most like Falcons part about it is he's like 10 times the linebacker that Deion Jones is now. I think that so Devondre Campbell, he has like an 85 grade on PFF, and Deion Jones is at 35. So it's kind of funny that the one that the Falcons ended up paying is the one that ended up not being so good. So that one was just kind of, you know, fanfare for me. But I also thought it was just a really cool story, because, you know, you really just don't see like this level of growth out of guys in a year's time, especially at this point in their career. But he did it. He's always had the physical tools to do it. And, you know, our friend Justice Mosqueda, he says that if, you know, this was a year without like TJ Watt or Myles Garrett or Micah Parsons, then Devondre Campbell gets like some serious votes for defensive player of the year. Like, he really has been that good and that key to the Packers defense.
I think linebacker is also a position that's been devalued a little bit in people's minds, a little bit like running back. It's just not, people don't find it as important and don't focus on it. But I remember watching him at Minnesota too, and he's just like a very like sort of prototypical what you want out of your linebackers now. I mean, he's tall, he can defend linebackers, he's like fairly quick, you know, like he's obviously not going to be as quick as a lot of guys, but he sort of puts it together as well as he can. I think he had like 4.458 40 at the combine. Mm-hmm. Just a guy like, you saw that he could do it, but I'd love if somebody would dig in, because you're right, like it's 5 years on, which, you know, granted, he's not that old, he's like 28 years old. Most, you wouldn't think for most humans, like, oh, he's done developing. But in the NFL, usually, like, who you are at age 25, 26 is who you're going to be. So I wonder if there's just a coach who got through to him or something, that, like you said, maybe it was just him doing, you know, enough reps, or if he just was put in the right situation here, because he has been very noticeable. If you're looking for it, like, that's the thing, right? Like, he's not as noticeable as Micah Parsons, because Dallas is just using Micah Parsons all over the field and letting him run at the quarterback all the time. You know, he has just been like such a solid part of what the Packers are doing, and just being in the right spot and patrolling that middle of the field, and just making, like you said, making tackles, just being a really sure tackler. Like, it's a little bit of a quiet performance, but he's just had a huge impact. So
yeah,
it is interesting. Who are some other guys who've gotten better this year? Are there any other players on that list?
I think staying with the Falcons, because I've gotten back to watching them a lot this year. Dude, AJ Terrell.
You weren't going to do that, man.
I wasn't going to, and then, you know what? I just, like, I'm going to stop lying to myself. And they started kind of winning some games, and Kyle Pitts looked as good as we thought he was going to be. So I kind of got intrigued. And, you know, the Cordell Patterson show. Who could turn that?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, you're right.
That's the problem with the Falcons. Like, yes, they suck, but they also have plenty of reasons to actually tune in and watch. Like, and then that's the frustrating nature with them. But I would go with AJ Terrell. I mean, he had a pretty good rookie year. Like, I thought he was definitely one of the best rookie corners. Last year, but he has taken that to just a whole nother level this year. Like, basically any metric you want to look at, the film. The dude, he's turned into like a legitimate shutdown all-pro cornerback. I don't really know how he didn't make the Pro Bowl. Maybe it's just because the Falcons are on a bad team, but I truthfully believe this season, you'd have a hard time finding a cornerback that played better than he did. If you're just you know, someone who's got some free time on their hands as the season winds down, you should definitely check out Game Pass, the All-22 from the Bills and Falcons game on Sunday. It's a snowstorm, and AJ Terrell is matched up one-on-one coverage for the entire game, basically every single play with Stephon Diggs. That was their design for the game. And just the balance, the footwork, like the control to be able to keep up with someone that quick in the snow while you're running backwards, like he's a real special player. And I think it's kind of funny that he has developed into like this generally elite cornerback, and no one was excited about the pick when it was announced. So, you know, sometimes you don't know everything and you just need to let things play out. And I think that Terrell's a good example of that.
Yeah. What did Terrell do to, I mean, the big thing with him was that he was a bigger guy, like 6'1" or something, which was still seen as like, oh, that's a little tall for a cornerback. Like, is he going to be quick enough? But now we've seen like a bunch of the best corners this year. You know, Trayvon Diggs is like 6'2". Patrick Surtain the second is 6'1". Like, obviously these guys are figuring it out. It's not the issue that maybe it was made out to be in the scouting community 2-3 years ago. Like, what did Terrell do to make up for whatever lacking he had in quote unquote quickness?
Well, for him, he's two things, patience and ball skills. Like, I think that he's done a really good job of kind of letting things come to him. And it's weird because you look at Terrell's like combine with the 20-yard shuttle and three cone drill, and they don't really scream like someone who's super agile. But you know, this is why, you know, the old school writers and scouts say this is why you kind of got to watch the games and really see with your eyes what's going on, because he's just really just never out of position. I mean, even if you go back to the 49ers game against the Falcons, like, there aren't many guys who can just man up in the slot and take on Deebo Samuel and break up a pass, but he's done it. He's done it against, you know, guys like Deebo Samuels, Mike Evans, Stephon Diggs, Robbie Anderson, like any type of receiver that you want. Like, he can play basically lockdown coverage on him. So I just think that the ascension from like solid starting quarterback to super duper elite is pretty impressive. And, you know, for the Falcons, look, that's one dude that you get to keep on your defense. And now you need to figure out basically the entire rest of the thing.
Yeah. Fun times, man. Fun times.
Yep.
All right. Let's talk about the which landing spots make sense for Jimmy Garoppolo. And I know that this is just, you are purely trolling our old friend Steven Ruiz here. But your feeling is that maybe the Panthers end up being the team that bites Jimmy Garoppolo. You include in here Ben Baldwin's, you know, a chart of Ben Baldwin's EPA per play statistic. And Garoppolo is fourth behind Mahomes. This is 2017 through 2021. So
yeah,
it's a big spread.
Since Garoppolo has been traded to the 49ers.
Right. Mahomes, Breeze, Rodgers, Garoppolo. And then Tom Brady is like actually fair. Like, there's like a decent amount of space between him and Tom Brady. It's not.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I think that this chart is a good example of, maybe you don't need to take EPA just as the only thing that you look at sometimes. I'm not trying to call out anyone exactly, but, you know, I think that there are some people out there who may be a little bit too reliant on EPA. And then when you see something like that, come on, right? We got to use our eyes and touch grass a little bit. But just in terms of Garoppolo, like, he's a better option than what the Panthers have. And I think that Matt Rhule, he's really backed himself into a corner here. Because, you know, he sold like the culture changer guy, but no one's really sure what he does. He's 0-for-3 on quarterback picks when if he had just, you know, taken Justin Fields at 8 or not signed Teddy Bridgewater, they could have had a much better option than where they're sitting at now. And now the Panthers, you've taken two upside swings this year with Darnold and Newton. Both of them have failed miserably. I mean, neither of those guys should be starting next year for you. So now, after you've missed for the upside, what are you going to chase? You're going to chase the floor to save your job. You're going to chase a nice high floor, someone that's not too flashy, someone that come in and execute the offense on time, make the throws in rhythm, all that blah, blah, blah crap that, you know, they talk about on the shows where they pretend that all these crappy quarterbacks are actually good. All right. That's Jimmy Garoppolo, man. And right. Guess what? You can have him because the 49ers are literally giving him away because they traded up to get Trey Lance. So, you know, and you know, that's another thing with EPA. You know, if Jimmy G is really the fourth best quarterback since 2017, you think the 49ers will be like in a rush to move on from him? Come on, let's use our heads here a little bit. You know, I just think that I don't think that it's a good match, like, on the field, because, you know, you don't have the same advantages in Carolina that you do in San Francisco, namely Trent Williams, who's playing like better than any left tackle in the history of the NFL right now. George Kittle, Kyle Shanahan, Debo Samuel, you know, all those guys aren't there. The Panthers offensive line is really, really awful right now. No one knows who their offensive coordinator is going to be. Christian McCaffrey is, you know, we're about to see if he's about to hit that running back hill. And they really have no cohesion on offense. But other than that, it's turning out great for them. and I can just see it in my eyes where Matt Rhule just looks at this as like, all right, this is going to be the guy that stabilizes our offense. Just completely ignoring everything else, everything we know about Jimmy Garoppolo as a player when things aren't working, and pull off that trade.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if we had an EPA over expected stat, then Jimmy Garoppolo would be way ahead. And, you know, we would attribute that to the fact that he's got, as you said, he's got a good offensive line and he's got Kyle Shanahan calling plays. You know, it's not that Garoppolo. So if you look at air yards on the same chart, you know, Drew Brees is only at 6.6. Like, we know that's right. Who Drew Brees was for the last 5 years of his career. He was just sort of taking whatever throw was there, and he was incredibly proficient at it, and it worked. He's number two on this. But Deshaun Watson is 7. And if you look at Deshaun Watson's stats among this group, he's got his completion percentage over expected is 4.2, and then his air yards is the highest, I'm pretty sure, at 9. And this is a guy, like, he had none of those advantages, right? He had a bad offensive line and he had bad coaching staffs. Like, that was a guy who was really elevating the team around him. Garoppolo, you know, as you write, anyone who watches Jimmy Garoppolo can see that he has deficiencies. Like, he's very good at doing what Kyle Shanahan asked him to do, which is basically throw the ball to guys flashing over the middle of the field. But he is not a very dynamic quarterback. He's not a quarterback that's going to make things happen when plays break down. And he's not a guy who's just going to stand in and produce plays if a defense is giving him a lot of static in front of him. Whereas with Trey Lance, you know, this is the guy who is the biggest unknown coming into the draft, right? Like, and obviously the 49ers thought they saw something. They traded up to get him. They've been reluctant to play him for whatever reason. It's not entirely clear, but finally he played, and you included his pass chart here, and it's just a thing of beauty. If you're a 49ers fan and you're accustomed to sort of the Jimmy G chart where there's a bunch of green dots in the middle of the field about seven to five yards deep, Lance is throwing the ball over the field. They didn't really unleash him. He only threw 23 passes, 16 for 23, but his air yards per attempt were 11.5. And he's more athletic than Jimmy Garoppolo. Like, just opens up so much for Kyle Shanahan to do with his offense. What did you see as you were trying to put together this story about Trey Lance?
It's just a totally different style of quarterbacking that they've had, since Shanahan's been there. I mean, think about the guys that they've gone after. Garoppolo, CJ Beathard, Nick Mullins, Brian Hoyer have been the guys that have started there since Shanahan took over. Like, I think they kind of saw the limits of what they were working with there, where, you know, you can only get so far with someone who can, like, run the offense as called, and that's it. And, you know, I think that Shanahan, you know, not to just totally blame those guys, but, you know, I think that Shanahan kind of liked those guys at first because he saw himself as someone who is, like, kind of out there playing Madden, like, where the quarterback is just, like, his joystick, and he's just kind of getting people into the right spots where they need to, which, hey, I mean, they've scored a lot of points doing that. I mean, he's had a lot of success, but, you know, I think one thing that he didn't really take into account as he moved from, like, Atlanta to San Francisco is, you know, the quarterback has to be able to do a little bit of playmaking on their own. Matt Ryan helped him out a lot with that in Atlanta. I mean, obviously Shanahan was great in there and they had a lot of good players, but you need a quarterback to kind of come in and elevate things for you. And he hasn't really had that since that 2016 season. So now, you know, you get someone like Trey Lance who might have like a Justin Herbert, Josh Allen level arm. I mean, this kid can absolutely rip it. Basically, anywhere he wants to put on the field, he can get it there in a second. And then you're going to get someone who can do well in the design run game stuff too. So this is just a totally different dynamic than what the 49ers have had in the past with their other quarterbacks. And I think it was kind of interesting, like, just to get the first glimpse of what that can look like. Now, he's like, obviously he's not going to throw for you know, 11.5 air yards per attempt every play. Like, that'll be higher than what James Winston has done over the past few years. So that might not be the game you want to play, but, you know, you get to at least have a bigger threat for big plays than just whatever Kyle can scheme up, because now you have someone who can, just with his physical prowess, can make plays before defenses can react and give his receivers time to catch and run up the field due to his arm strength. And also he can make his own stuff happen. So, you know, I think that it'll start to become more cohesive as they get like a full offseason with Trey as a starter. But I thought that Sunday was a cool glimpse at like what a more aggressive and like powerful Shanahan passing offense looks like.
Right. Yeah. I'm looking forward to, you know, him having an offseason and hopefully feeling some level of comfort in playing Lance and, you know, a little bit like when the Ravens, you know, obviously a different style, but when the Ravens showed a little bit of Lamar and then took the offseason and built an offense actually around his talents and he went out and won the MVP. You know, that's obviously a high bar. I'm not saying that's where this is headed, but I do think that that'll be something we're talking about all summer and looking forward to and sort of trying to trace out is how Lance will actually end up being used and what that opens up for the 49ers.
Right.
All right. The last of the four verts, diving back into the Falcons. this time you're looking at the shoddy cap space situation and whether or not this is going to lead to them having to trade Grady Jarrett. Again, you know, this is, again, one of those franchises. I'm sorry to belabor this with you, but one of these franchises that it's just, like, not entirely clear what the overall plan is at this point. Just because they, you know, they have Matt Ryan, who's I've been seeing your tweets, and, like, he's certainly still a very, very good NFL quarterback. But at some point, unless Tom Brady's the new standard, at some point, Matt Ryan is probably going to start to drop off. And can the Falcons possibly build anything in time to make best use of him?
It's like a
bigger question.
And I think that, you know, shipping off your two best players in back-to-back years doesn't really help.
not a good team building strategy.
Yeah. But, you know, I think the Falcons, like, I think that it's okay for some fans to be like encouraged by this year. I mean, there were some pretty fun moments. They played Buffalo a lot tougher than I thought they were going to this past Sunday. So, you know, I think there's things to be encouraged by, but it seems still pretty far away. You have another tough offseason, you know, where you're still like paying for the sins of the past regime coming up. Like, this is the last offseason where you kind of got to tough it through before the money really opens up in 2023, but you're still going to have to make some tough decisions. And unfortunately, the Falcons, as they enter the offseason, just according to SpotTrack, like, they have like $11 million in cap space and like 32 players on the roster or signed under their contract for next year. So you're going to need to like cut off a pretty big chunk of change if you want to work and try to sign someone while also getting your draft picks, you know, sign onto the roster as well once that comes towards the end of the offseason. So unfortunately, like, they might have to explore trading Grady Jarrett because they haven't really put themselves in a situation where they have many other options. Like, they restructured Matt Ryan, and honestly, I think that Arthur Blank is just so attached to the idea of having Matt Ryan as his quarterback, which is, he's the owner, this is prerogative. I mean, there's been a lot of success. Dumber things have happened in the NFL, so I don't think that Matt Ryan's going anywhere. But, you know, the Deion Jones contract made that a little bit harder to trade with the restructure. You might even have to package a pick with that just because of how badly he's played this year. And, you know, if a team is trying to get their hands on one of the last Falcons marquee players, trading Grady Jarrett makes a lot of sense, or trading for him. You know, the Falcons would save $16.5 million against the cap, so they would, you know, more than double their cap space with the Grady Jarrett trade. But, you know, at the same time, you're losing Grady Jarrett. And I know that he had a down year this year, kind of switching over to the DNP system and, quite frankly, playing with a bunch of scrubs around him. But it would still be a huge, huge loss to lose someone like that, that you found in the fifth round drafted and then would have to trade because you've kind of been irresponsible with your money over the past few years while you were chasing the ring with a team that didn't really have the quality of a Super Bowl contender. And, you know, these are the consequences for the new regime as they build with it. You know, you have to trade Julio Jones one offseason, and you might have to trade Grady Jarrett the next to also cancel out like the cap ramifications that they're still facing from the Julio Jones trade. Like Julio Jones' account made about $15 million worth of dead cap and for 2022, and then trading Grady Jarrett would clear up like 16.5. So, you know, you have to trade Grady Jarrett to kind of recoup on some of the Julio cap space, which is just kind of depressing to think about. I mean, that would be a terrible blow for this defense. But, you know, I, at the same time, if someone offers you like a first round pick and like a fifth round pick or first and the fourth for Grady Jarrett, I think that that might be a situation where the Falcons pull a trigger on that, because, you know, you kind of get the first round pick back and they need those cheap, long contracts as they start to fill out the rest of this team.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's the shame of, like, you know, I think everybody wants to see Matt Ryan finish out his career with the Falcons. Like, he's a guy who we associate with the franchise and he's had a lot of great years there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But, and his cap hit's not even, like, right now, it's not that bad. But, like, moving down the line, you know, it's just hard for a team to rebuild when, I think, what's his cap at, $27 million this year? It's just really hard for a team to rebuild when you have that sort of hit. Like, the hack of the NFL is that you can draft a rookie quarterback and not have to pay that and build the roster other ways. And if that quarterback can provide anywhere near the level of play that you're getting from a veteran, then it allows you to sort of build up. And it's just the Falcons right now do not seem to really have a plan for transitioning and making it work. And like you said, they end up just having to trade guys that you know, that, like, just a goldmine guy, a guy that you came out of nowhere and is now going to, could be a huge part of your team, and you end up having to move on just to be able to fill other spots. It's not a fun situation for fans to have to go through.
Yep, it sucks. Yeah. I don't really know what else there is to say about that. Not having a good time.
Not enjoyable.
But, yeah, that's where the Falcons are. You know, maybe they can get creative with some other contracts, but, you know, if they're trying to get some cap space, that's the easiest way to do it. As of now.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about, you know, a darker side of the NFL, a side that, you know, I think anyone who cares about the game should want to understand what it means for former players and what they're going through and how the game leaves them. I wrote a story, I think it ran a couple days before Christmas, where I talked to Casey Fitzsimmons, who played 7 years at tight end for the Detroit Lions, one of the most probably unlikely NFL careers in history. He did not play football until he was a senior in high school. He played on an 8-man team in Chester, Montana, which is way up near the Canadian border, and then he played at an NAIA school in also in Montana. You know, and just a guy who probably should never have made the NFL. Ended up going to Lions mini camp or rookie camp, I guess, at the time as an undrafted free agent, and did enough to impress and get a spot. I mean, really was a little bit more of a special teams guy. I mean, he had a bunch of tackles throughout his career. He's famous for returning an onside kick for a touchdown against the Lions. Had an epic comeback against the Bears. But those Lions team, you know, this was in the midst of the Lions just being awful. He was on the 0-16 team. You know, he was there sort of toward the end when they got Calvin Johnson and then 2 years later drafted Matt Stafford. It was actually in a game with Matt Stafford that Casey suffered his final concussion. He caught a pass like sort of over the middle, turned upfield, and Tank Johnson, I don't know if you guys remember him, he was defensive tackle playing with the Bengals at the time. Casey kind of got held up and Tank Johnson rammed him in the head. You know, Casey sort of used his helmet to accept the hit too. It's a very common thing to see in football back then.
Right.
And that was Casey, by his count, probably his 7th or 8th diagnosed concussion at the time. And he had many others throughout his many other times that he got his bell rung during his career, which was relatively short by most football players' standards, just because he did not play as a kid. He gets this concussion, and Casey and I actually, we started talking years ago, probably 5-6 years ago, when players. Players kept committing suicide and ending up dead. The reports were on about discovering CTE. And Casey reached out to me and offered to share his medical records with me. And so I went through his records from the Detroit Lions and just could really get sort of a behind the scenes look at how in the early 2000s or mid 2000s and that concussion that Casey got actually happened about 2 weeks before the NFL finally admitted that concussions could cause lasting damage. You know, there was essentially the book from ESPN investigative writers was called League of Denial, because for a long time, the NFL just denied that concussions could have a lasting impact. They finally did it 2 weeks after Casey got hurt, but it was still like back then, you know, it was still basically like you get your bell rung, you know, it was still not seen as being as much of a problem as maybe we see it now. I'm not sure that we even pay enough attention to it now. I talked to Calvin Johnson for the story, and Calvin was talking about how tough Casey was. And also, you know, Casey sort of saw it as like, I have to play through injury because otherwise I'm not going to be in the league. I have to get up after a hit, you know, and it's documented in his records that he took one hit on a Sunday and then played in the Thanksgiving game 4 days later. And probably both were concussions. That was earlier in his career. And it's just, you know, the doctors in the notations here, it's like, well, Casey really wants to play again. Seems like he's good to go because he wants to play again. And that's Calvin Johnson sort of said the same thing. Like Calvin Johnson was perhaps the most talented wide receiver ever. And even he thought like, I have to, if I get my bell rung, I just have to play again. I can maybe take a day off. So Casey detailed for me sort of what happened to him after this hit. He basically has no memory of his life for about 2 years after the hit, which includes the birth of his daughter a few weeks later. And then him starting his second career, which he owns a ranch out in Montana and has been ranching out there for the last decade or so. But just, you know, and it's his storyline is one that we see happen everywhere. The reason that I wrote the story when I did about Casey after talking to him for so many years is that the week prior, there had been two reports to come out. There was the Philip Adams case that we talked about a little bit on our show. It was a journeyman NFL player who had played tackle football since he was 7 years old. And he ended up shooting six people he didn't know and then killing himself. And they found CTE in his brain. And then Vincent Jackson, who turns out drank himself to death, was found in a hotel room alone at age 38. He also had CTE. So there was it was sort of bubbling up. And Casey and I reconnected and you know, he really felt that it was time for his story to get out there and to talk about it and to really let people know what it's like for players going through this. He talked to me a lot about, again, I have records in here of him trying to access the NFL and the NFLPA's programs that are supposed to provide money for former players and him being denied, even though his own doctors are saying, oh, yes, he's definitely permanently disabled. He's going through headaches 4 or 5 hours a day. Mm-hmm. Casey was drinking heavily after his concussion, too. You know, he was sort of felt like he needed it to be able to talk to people to get the courage. He was dealing with a lot of anxiety at that point. Just his brain was not functioning the way that he wanted it to. He was moody. He was irritable. He was afraid that he would be violent. He was basically sequestering himself away. And so it's just a lot, you know, he detailed all this for me. And it's hard not to think about that as we watch the Antonio Brown thing over the weekend, the Antonio Brown, you know, leaving in the middle of the game, sort of taking his jersey off, very clearly trying to get the attention of people on the sideline and people in the stands. And we know that AB has had all sorts of issues. And it created this discussion after the game of like, of people saying, I wonder if he has, if his brain has been damaged by football. I wonder if he has CTE. And then other people saying it's irresponsible to say that. Those are shitty tweets. And so I wanted to just sort of try to wrap all that together because for me, where I sit after working on this story and writing about some of this stuff over the years, I think it probably is fair to wonder if Antonio Brown has been damaged by football. It is entirely pointless to try to speculate, does he have CTE? Because CTE cannot be diagnosed in living people. It can only be done in deceased individuals with a brain study. Obviously, people are working on figuring that out now. But the point is that even regular traumatic brain injury that doesn't, you know, that might not lead to CTE, anyone who's had brain injury can exhibit the things that Antonio Brown did. And Chris Nowinski wrote about this. Chris Nowinski, the former football player and wrestler who is the CEO, the head of the Concussion Legacy Foundation, who helps a lot of players and families going through this, wrote that, you know, it doesn't really matter, because what we know is that if your brain is beat up, if your brain is damaged, even if it's not by concussion, Vincent Jackson thought he never had a diagnosed concussion. Like, according to him, he never got diagnosed with a concussion. And that's what AB has said too. Like, AB says, oh, I only had one bad hit. The Vontaze Burfict hit that everyone remembers, where it was awful, looked terrible. Antonio Brown has said, oh, that's the only time I got hit hard. But we know that actually what it is the accumulation of little hits is what does it. Phillip Adams was not a guy who was out there laying big hits, but he'd been taking hits since he was seven.
Right.
And that's Casey Fitzsimmons was lucky, but he was a basketball player who got asked to play tight. So he doesn't have that history of hits. So and if he had, his story may have been totally different. He may have ended up dead. You know, he told me that he contemplated suicide, that he thought that he was not going to survive the first few years after his career because of how his brain felt. So this, you know, this discussion is, it's a difficult one to have, right? Because we all love watching football. We all want to continue to watch it. People don't want to feel guilty when they're doing a thing that they love to do to relax on the weekend. But there is a lot to this. How did you feel about watching Antonio Brown go through that on Sunday?
Oh, it was okay. Well, I mean, my initial reaction was just like to chuckle a little bit, because that was just so absurd. Like, he's literally taking his shirt off and like doing jumping jacks while he's running to the locker room on the field, like while players are on the field. And I think it was a report from The Athletic where someone said that the security at MetLife thought that he was a fan that had run onto the field. And, you know, you see the other videos where like Mike Evans is trying to deal with him, and he kind of goes from like funny to like, what the hell is going on here? And, you know, I guess the one thing that I initially thought that was just kind of bizarre, and now I'm kind of curious to figure out like what actually happened there, because the reports that are coming out really from both sides aren't really passing the sniff test, where, you know, Antonio Brown said that, you know, according to Rappaport, Antonio Brown said that his ankle was hurting and Bruce Arians told him to get back in the game anyways, which doesn't really sound like it makes a whole lot of sense to me. And then you have, you know, the other side where the Bucks, like, they're not really saying what's going on. So, you know, it's interesting to me that like we're especially with like just with this specific situation, because obviously I know that Antonio Brown, he has a lot of stuff where you can talk about, you know, mental health and, you know, CTE and brain damage and stuff like that. But I do think it's interesting that with this specific incident, we don't really have that many facts on what happened besides Antonio Brown running away during the middle of the game. So, you know, just personally, I would like to get a little bit more information, even though I know it's not likely that we're going to really get anything probably from either camp, because it's probably not very flattering for anyone involved. But, you know, it just is kind of, you know, I guess I kind of struggle with this a little bit, because I don't find Antonio Brown to be particularly, you know, a person that I want to show like sympathy towards. But when you see someone like their life is just deteriorating in front of you, and they just keep making the same mistakes over and over and over and over again. And not only like are they making these mistakes, but like they just seem to not be interested in trying to learn from their mistakes or their behavior, or looking at their behavior and seeing like how messed up this is. It kind of does make you wonder like what is football doing to these people's bodies? Like, is it a situation where maybe Antonio Brown is kind of always the jackass, and, you know, these hits are exacerbating those worst personality traits. I mean, I'm not a doctor. I don't know. It just kind of makes you think all these different things. And maybe it's just a symptom of, you know, growing up homeless in Miami and beating the odds to even not just to get to the NFL, but to get to college and then to get drafted as a 6th round pick. And then, you know, you beat the odds.
The best play, you know, the best player at his position.
Right. You know, I mean, dude, Antonio Brown was so good that even with all this, he can still end up as a first ballot Hall of Famer. Like, you know, to me, there's two dudes when I think of receivers for like the 2010 era. It's Julio and AB. Like, those are the two guys.
Right.
You know, Calvin Johnson had like a little stint there, but I'm just talking about from like 2010 to 2020. Like, it's those two dudes. So, it's just really bizarre that he just can't seem to get his life together. And, you know, it's just kind of sad when you think about how like this game gives people so much in their lives, but it also takes a lot from you at the end of it. I mean, I'd have friends in my life where, you know, we only made it to D3, or, you know, some of my friends played like your Power 5 ball, a couple made it to the NFL, but most of my friends, like, where we just made to D3, like, you know, we talk about, like, I don't always feel right on days, and I wonder why. I wonder if, like, how much football had to do with that, because, you know, you can say that he only got diagnosed with one concussion, but it really doesn't take all that much for you to get a concussion, you know? I think it was Channing Crowder, linebacker for the Dolphins back in the day. He said that he estimated he got at least one concussion per game, which honestly, like, if you play football, that sounds pretty realistic to me. Right. And the culture within
it doesn't need to be a concussion. Like, all those count, you know, like, no matter what, your brain is potentially getting hurt.
You kind of feel like there's going to be one hit where each game where you're like, oof, that didn't feel too good. But the culture of the sport kind of demands that you go back in there, or else you're letting your team down. You're letting, you know, your school down. You're letting your city down, what have you. So it's just all these toxic things that end up creating like an Antonio Brown. You know, it's just kind of hard to parse like how much of this is like societal problems from his upbringings, him just kind of being a dick, or football doing this to his brain. I struggle with like finding sympathy for him because of all the things that he's accused of in his past. But I think it's fair to ask, why are you behaving this way? Right. I think asking the question, why are you behaving this way, doesn't excuse like what you've done, but you have to figure out why this is going on, because it's so far out from the norm of what, because I mean, there are a lot of guys who have, you know, mental health issues and CTE, and you see it in their lives, but they're not acting like this. So I think that you can ask what is going on here without excusing the behaviors, because if he's going to get help, if he's interested in getting help, then why you're doing this is a really important thing to figure out.
Right. And this is one of the things that we can't know, right? Like, we don't know what Antonio Brown's like every day. And that's the issue, right? It's irresponsible to diagnose him based on the things we see, right? Because we don't see it. You know, we just see these outbursts, and maybe it is just that he's a diva and he just wants attention and he just does shitty things because that's who he wants to be. Like, that's a possibility. But to understand how his brain is functioning, you need to have someone who's with him all the time. And who's been with him for years, right? And that's another advantage that Casey Fitzsimmons had, was that he met his future wife. They were just like kids playing at an NAIA school in Montana. Like, there was no, you know, and then they got married right away, and she was with him that whole time. So she saw his brain change, and it wasn't, their relationship wasn't about football. It wasn't built around that. And one thing Casey said to me that really stuck with me was that for so many of these guys, they become, it's not that they lack a support system, it's that they are the support system for other people, right? They make the money and they bring their family and friends out of poverty, or that, you know, they become the center, or they attract people who
who only want them for their fame and riches. And those are people who are not going to say, you know, hey, I think you're acting weird, or didn't you forget your keys yesterday? Like, why are you forgetting things so much? Why are you getting angry about this thing that you shouldn't be getting angry about? I think we need to take you to a neurologist. Like, it seems that Antonio Brown has no one around him like that. I think we know that NFL teams are probably not great at really looking at players that way. You know, I hope that they're getting a little bit better, but you know, it sure seems like the Bucs just saw Antonio Brown as a guy who would be really good at catching the football and would be a nice weapon to have on their team, and not, you know, even just the reaction after the game. Like, again, it's a heated moment, and clearly, Tom Brady didn't really want to talk about it. He did say, like, let's treat it with compassion. Brady had a great, a great reaction to it. Like, he was really sort of centered AB as a human. But we need better programs for players going through this sort of thing. Cause Vincent Jackson knew, right? Like, he understood, he read about CTE. He watched the movies about it. He did not want his sons to play tackle football because he didn't want them taking unnecessary hits until they were in high school. He wanted them to wait, which is, you know, the recommendation of most doctors who study this is, if you can, just put off getting hit for as long as you can. So he understood it, but when he started having issues, when his drinking started getting out of control, when he was unable to control his emotions, he didn't put the two together. Yeah, you know, and that's the issue, is that we feel like we know more, but we're still not, we don't have that step where people are actually getting the help they need. Right. And that's, I think, the fear right now with Antonio Brown, is that we all saw this happen. And like, the next night, two nights later, he's at an NBA game. Like, is anyone actually in his ear saying, hey, like, let's actually get this looked at. Let's go through the tests. And the tests are terrible. You know, it's like, it's very,
yeah,
it takes hours upon hours. It's not fun. You know, you're sitting there going through physical tests, they're doing mental tests on you. It's an inexact science, to say the least, to try to figure out how someone's brain is working. And so there's a reason the players don't want to do it too. But we just need to get to the point where people like Antonio Brown can get help, where they're put in a position where someone has the ability to say to them, hey, you need to think about this and get looked at. So it's a story that it's just not going away anytime soon. Like, there's so many players out there dealing with this, more players than we could even fathom, are going through this. And a lot of them just don't want to speak out. They love football. They loved playing football. They love the idea of maybe being back in football. You know, Calvin Johnson, he gave like an amazing Hall of Fame speech, one of the most astonishing I've ever seen, where he said, I mean, he opened up by saying this game was brutal on me. You know, by my second year, I basically knew that I could not play football for that long. And like, you think about Megatron, and he's the most physical wide receiver we've ever seen. You know, it didn't seem like he was getting beat up, right? It seemed like he was doing the beating up. But he was a guy who just came out right after his career and said that how difficult it was, how hard it had been on him. And he's dedicated himself to trying to make it better for other former players. He's investing in cannabis and investing in neurological, an app essentially that helps people make their brains better. Mm-hmm. And so he's really tried to push, you know, he's a guy who sort of stepped out of sort of the football bubble to try to talk about it in a little bit more of an honest way. But it's just hard. It's a really hard situation. So I hope to keep writing about it and, you know, connecting with former players and seeing how they're doing.
Yep.
So let's transition then to talking about young players. Well, this isn't happy either, but I mean, we can make it happy. Over the weekend, Kirk Herbstreit was on College Game Day and went on sort of a mini rant about how players opting out of bowl games means that they don't really love football. And then Desmond Howard jumped in and said that he felt players were entitled, that playing in a bowl game is a reward for a good season, and you should be thankful that you get to play in a bowl game. Your take on that, Charles McDonald?
Dude, it's 2022. Dude, Kirk and Dez, like, they were like 15, 18 bowl games when you guys last played college football.
Right.
there's like almost 50 now. These games don't mean anything. I mean, the last episode that we had before we took a break, I literally just sat here and named like all the dumbass sponsors that are part of these bowl games. I think to have a rant like that is really condescending, because you're kind of like insinuating that these kids, because like, I refuse to believe that Kirk and Dez don't know the game. I mean, they work for ESPN. Right. That's the reason of why they work for the company. That's basically why college football is in the spot where it is right now, where people only care about the last two games at the end of the season with the playoffs. If you work for a company that has basically diluted this product in the way that it has, I don't think that you're allowed to not understand why things are the way they are now. And if I'm going to take that stance, and I just kind of have to believe that you're being condescending and thinking that these kids are a lot dumber than they actually are. Anyone with a phone now can Google how much is, you know, ESPN and, you know, the SEC network, like how much is that deal worth? You know, it's millions and millions and millions of dollars. They know that these schools are pulling in millions of dollars from donations, sales, like what have you. And, you know, the players are kind of looking back at it like, well, damn, well, where's my cut? And I think that we're starting to see that this idea is coming more and more common, especially as like the NIL stuff really gets cracked in college football. And you just kind of see that the money is just, it's right there in front of you. Like what all this costs is not amateur sports in any way, shape or form. It's professional sports that has been shaped as tagged as amateurism so that the people at the top can continue to rake in all this cash without really having to give anything back to the people that are putting the actual product on the field. Because if there's no football game, there's no money, you know, like it all starts right there. So I think to say, you know, the things that he said where these kids don't love football that much, I think that's kind of crazy, because, you know, I think that you can really love something and also make really practical, informed decisions on how to go about it. It's not like, you know, this isn't like most hobbies that you love, you know, like it's not like, if I like drawing or something, if that's my thing, something that I'm really passionate about, I can draw every single day for the rest of my life and not injure myself. Right. If I want to play football for a really long time, and more importantly, if I want to make that money at the level that I hope to be able to, there might have to be some sacrifices along the way until you can get that cash, especially as the world like further descends into madness, and you know we keep holding on to the strong ideals of late stage American capitalism. Like, you've got to put food on the table. You've got to be able to support your family, yourself, the people that care about you, maybe even your community in certain and for certain people.
Right.
And if you can say, all right, well, I have all this riding on me. I have a future, I have generational wealth one step away. And if I skip the Cheetos Bowl, the Tostitos Bowl, the Tony the Tiger Bowl, if I skip that, then I'm straight. Okay, that sounds like a pretty, right, pretty reasonable decision to me. And I don't think that we can forget that the playoff has like totally just ruined the meaning of any of these games. Like,
yeah,
can you imagine 20 years ago someone telling you that kids are going to start skipping the Rose Bowl? Like, that is baffling. And then I think the most, you know, maybe the most important thing about all of this, which, you know, that they didn't think about during their boomer rant on College Game Day, was the NFL has told you very clearly they don't give a damn about these bowl games.
Right.
Leonard Fournette skipped his bowl game. Christian McCaffrey skipped his bowl game when they were coming out. Fournette went 4. McCaffrey went 8.
Micah Parsons skipped it in this higher year. Jamar Chase and Micah Parsons both skipped last year. Obviously, it was a pandemic, but like,
right. You know, but they showed that they don't even care about entire seasons anymore if you're a good enough player. Think about the guy.
And they probably never did. I mean,
it's all crap. Like, the stuff they feed you about, oh, teammates, blah, blah, blah. But right, when it's time to put their money where their mouth is, Trey Lance is going number 3 overall, and he's played one football game since 2019. You know, right. you see what the deal is there. So not only are these guys coming out and skipping a year, but you have Jamar Chase putting up almost 300 yards on Sunday. Micah Parsons in the Defensive Player of the Year award race. Trey Lance is about to be a playoff starter potentially. Rashawn Slater skipped last year. He might be the best young left tackle in the football. You have other guys like Penei Sewell, Gregory Rousseau. These guys are getting paid even though they aren't taking the risk of playing that last year of college football. And obviously, like, last year was different, but it's opened the door for you to realize that you don't need college football as much as you used to get to where you want to be in the NFL, as long as you can prove to them at some point before you get to the NFL that you are worthy of a high draft pick. And I think that that's going to be the next shift that these guys aren't ready for. Like, if you're, I don't know who would be like one of the best young college football players, but like if Bryce Young today, if he said, actually, I'm just going to go and chill for a year, and then I'll catch you guys in 2024 when it's time, or 2023 when it's time for the draft.
When I'm allowed to get drafted.
Right, when I'm allowed to get drafted. He's still going to get drafted really
high. By your rules. You know, like, he didn't make the rules. Like, these guys, like, one thing for me is, like, I don't even know why you get mad about it. Like, I went to Penn State. Penn State had, like, six defensive players out. Jahan Dotson obviously didn't play. Like, what? Like, I mean, I guess I want to see them play against Arkansas in the Outback Bowl. Like, I guess that would be fun. But guess what? It's also fun to see, like, recruits that I remember reading about 2 years ago finally get a chance to play. And that's also better for the long-term health of the program, right? Now those guys got snaps, and they got 4 weeks of practice with the ones so that they are even more ready for spring practice. Or now James Franklin knows, like, oh, I gotta go to the transfer portal to try to replace so-and-so. Like, it's better for your team too. Like, it's just like pure sentimentality that you want to see these guys play in random bowl games for one more game. But like, dude, they've given you 12, whatever, how many were, you know, that's the other thing is Herbstreit. And when those guys played, like, this, the season was much shorter. Now seasons last much longer. You know, these guys are taking more hits. They're playing longer. Like, just don't even worry about it. Like, and it certainly does not mean that these guys are not dedicated to football. Like, I mean, that's just
it's a bowl game. Team. Like, it's dumb. And I think that we kind of get caught up in the idea of selfishness being like inherently bad when it's not really in these cases, because I don't view as a situation where someone has been getting exploited really for, you know, millions of dollars. Right. You know, these are the caliber
all
of players
of a sudden standing up right. saying,
yeah, because these are the caliber of players that we're talking about. Like, right. we're not talking about, you know, your backup left tackle. We're talking about like guys who are going to be high first round picks in the NFL draft. Like, if they decide that, all right, well, I've made you guys enough money, I'm about to go protect myself so I can get mine. I just think if you're hating on that, you should really look on the inside and figure out, like, why does this bother you so much? And I think really as a point in general, we should get to the point where we don't really care what decision kids make on these bowl games either way. Like, if Matt Corral wants to play in a bowl game,
right,
that's okay. his like, prerogative. That's
fine.
If he wants to, that's fine. If he doesn't, that's okay. But I also think it kind of sucks, like, when Matt Corral goes out there and get hurt and people are scolding him. Like, I don't think that that's like part of the spirit of it either, because it should just be about making the choice that you want and what feels right to you. And, you know, you can get hurt any single time that you step out on that football field, that practice room, that practice field, that weight room. And, you know, it's a crazy game. So, you know, that's why players are sitting out. But if you want to play and that gets hurt, I don't think that that's worthy of, you know, scolding either.
Right. Right. One last thing I want to say on this is this, it's just frustrating that Herbstreit and Howard are the guys talking about this. Like, obviously these are guys that we've watched for years, right? Like, I'm very used to watching these guys. Like, they're an important part of college football, but like, ESPN, come on, you got all these other smart people. Like, Mike Golic Jr. is on your staff. Like, get somebody there who can offer some nuance, who can add something else to the debate. Like Golic Jr. went on Twitter eventually, and he's got to be careful, right? Like he can't take on the biggest people at ESPN. But he says there's no conversation about current CFB players and their mentality that can be had fairly without acknowledging the way the sport has changed around them. We got to leave the judgment words at home. 100%. Like somebody needed to say that on the show, though. Like put somebody on the show who can say it's totally different. Like it's college football is nothing like what it was when Desmond Howard and Kirk Herbstreit played. You know, the whole process, like kids are going to camp as seventh and eighth graders. They're spending their whole summers doing football camps to try to get ready to get just to get recruited. And then once they get recruited, they have to sort it out. It's so much more complicated. There's 100 different recruiting reporters calling them and asking for their top five schools. Like it's just the business around it has exploded. Like everything you're talking about is totally different. And it's frustrating to me that Howard and Herbstreit, who could get anyone on the phone, right? Like they could call any of these guys and say, hey, why'd you make this decision? Or they could talk to their teammates. Were you offended by this decision? Do you feel like this guy let your team down? Like, do the research, man. Talk to people. You work for ESPN and you're the biggest names in college football. Like you can actually do some work here and maybe even help fix the problem. If you really want guys to play in the bowl game, what's a way to make that happen? Like how can you make it more palatable for players to want to be involved? Like, just step up and do it. Don't just sit there and launch bombs from your seat on Saturday morning and make all these kids look bad. I mean, this is a really bad look. Yep. All right. We've been talking forever, so we're gonna log off, I think. We'll talk we'll talk Thursday about the playoff scenario. Look ahead to some week 18 games. Still feels weird to say that, can't lie. But we will look at that. We'll sort of dig in a little bit more on where things are going. I think you might have your regrets. Some regrets.
Yeah, I'm gonna write something about like takes we had wrong, mainly so I can get these Bengals fans off my back.
We owe Bengals fans so many apologies. Yeah, we gotta get Steven on for he called Joe Burrow baby arm for a very long time.
Yeah, I'm still not gonna apologize to Zach Taylor though.
Coach NFL Coach of the Year Zach Taylor will not get an apology from us.
Absolutely not. And I mean, I'll explain later, but I still think that he is not very good at this. So we'll talk about that later.
It'll be a good show. All right, thanks for joining us. Find us on Twitter. I'm at Chris Corman. He's at Forverts. And we'll talk to you next time. Take care.
The Counter, an NFL podcast from USA Today Sports.
Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.